evening, everyone. It's great to see such a good number out tonight, especially as we, we're basically going through a very important day in our church, and a day that's going to determine where we go from here and affect our future. So it's good to see so many people out. I just want to briefly describe what's going to happen tonight. As you've already know, Noel preached this morning, and he will not be preaching tonight, but he will be giving his testimony. And his wife, Regina, will come up and give a testimony as well. And then there will be a period of myself asking Noel a number of pre-prepared questions. We have 8 questions here that we've already discussed. We've already given to Noel, give him an opportunity to answer those questions. And then we're going to open the floor to questions from the congregation to Noel. Okay, so if you have any questions of Noel at that point, then you're more than welcome to ask them when we open up the floor. After that, we'll close the service. Noel and Regina will leave, and we will have a business meeting, essentially, for all the members and any adherents that wish to stay. And if any of the members do not have a ballot, didn't get one when you come in the door, make sure you get one before we vote, because we will be voting at the end of that meeting following the service. I just want to very quickly go over the job profile and the associate pastor profile, the profile of the person that our search team looked for, and the job that we were looking for that person to do. None of this will come as a surprise to you, with the spiritual qualifications coming from 1 Timothy, Titus, and 1 Peter. Not to be a recent convert, able to teach, a good reputation and above reproach, hospitable, self-controlled, and gentle, not quarrelsome, overbearing, or quick-tempered, not a lover of money and does not pursue gain by dishonest means, loves what is good and is upright and holy, is temperate and disciplined, not given to drunkenness, manages his household and children well, has a strong marriage, if married, in this case he is, eagerly seeks to fulfill a godly leadership and provide a healthy spiritual example to the flock or to the congregation. He would be a born-again believer, baptized by immersion, walking closely with the Lord, devoted to biblical pastoral ministry. He will display and emphasize, both in his personal life and public ministry, a dependence on prayer, and will have a strong commitment to both private as well as corporate prayer. He has a desire to build relationships with and to disciple youth, young adults, new believers, and he has a burden for the salvation of lost sinners. He will be a godly man who has a heart for the people, capable motivator, encourager, and has the ability to wisely counsel others from Scripture. He is an effective teacher and preacher of the Word. He shall be in complete agreement with the NF, or with our church's statement of faith, and hold to the church's constitution and any resolutions of our church. He has received formal theological training at a recognized evangelical institution and continues to have a strong commitment to ongoing personal training and development in this area. He is able to work effectively with multiple staff, and he has administrative skills in proper time management, goal setting, strategic planning, delegation, and ability to prioritize. Quite the person. So you have to ask Noel if he fits that description later on. The job description, basically, I'm just going to summarize it. We are looking for someone to take a load off, a big load, off the shoulders of our current pastor and our senior pastor, Jacques Nadeau, who we all know and love, and he works very hard, and he puts in way more than the 40 hours a week we officially pay him for. And we all know that, and we all appreciate that, but we also know that he could wear out and burn out if we don't get him some help. And so that has been the goal for the last couple of years, is really to get some help for the pastor and spread the burden a bit, as well as give us the ability to run and expand some of the ministries that we currently have, but also create some new ones. So with that in mind, although this new pastor's associate position will cover a number of responsibilities, I just want to say, for example, this position will oversee youth ministries in this church, but it does not mean we're hiring a youth pastor. I just want to be clear on that. This person will oversee that ministry, meaning that Betty and John Wasalius and others who are in that ministry right now will continue, and will be the ones that the associate pastor would work with to oversee that ministry. Okay, so it's not like we're hiring a youth pastor, although this pastor would be responsible for youth. Does that make sense? So when I go through this, each of these ministries would fall into that same category. This position will cover youth ministries, college and career ministries, small group ministries, which is one of the new programs we really wish to start in this church. Further responsibilities would be administrative in nature, with regards to the office and running the church and the day-to-day functions along with our senior pastor. Periodic preaching of the word, whether it be in Sunday school, midweek studies or Bible study Tuesday night, for example, or when our senior pastor is away, he could fill the pulpit when our senior pastor is away. And other ministry expectations would be, of course, the visitation and attending the various meetings and so on, as well as being an elder of our church and acting as an elder and overseer of this church. And I could go through more details, but basically it's a jack-of-all-trades position to some degree, but it's a very important position because it's going to allow us to expand and enhance the ministries we already have and expand and create new ones as well. So that is the pastoral job description. That is the pastoral profile of who we're looking for, and I just wanted to make those clear before you hear Noel's testimony and the testimony of his wife. So without further ado, Noel, you can come on up and give us your testimony, and then Regina can come up whenever she is going to do that, and following that, I'll come and ask you some questions.
Okay. Well, that is quite the list of qualifications, I have to say. I was wanting to run out the door when he got about halfway through. I know how thoroughly unqualified I am. This is one of the things that our president, when I graduated seminary, he drilled into our heads in the graduation speech. But just God's help is the thing that makes any of us. God's qualified. None of us are. But anyway. My testimony. Well, I was born, and for the first 12 years of my life, I was raised in a little town down near Glencoe, Ontario, a little town called Newbury. My parents were in the grocery business, and for most of my life, they owned grocery stores. So I grew up in the grocery business with my parents, knowing the retail industry quite well. My parents were not believers. I don't think they were, and I think they would tell you that they probably weren't until I was about 12 years old. And we moved from that small town to another town called Wyoming, Ontario, down near Sarnia. And our family were members of the United Church. And even from when I was little, my parents had always taken us out to church, out to the United Church. The one that I grew up in when I was very small, the minister was actually a fairly faithful guy. I think he was a pretty strong believer. Again, not quite sure where my parents were. But when we moved to Wyoming, the United Church we began to attend turned out to be what is your pretty typical United Church. And there was very little, if anything, of the gospel. I didn't enjoy going, and I don't think they enjoyed it all that much either. So it wasn't long, and they began to become kind of disillusioned with that church, just because there was no fellowship at all. Nobody wanted to. It was just a thing you did on Sunday morning, and as soon as church was over, people left. And they began to make a few different friends in town, and some of those friends were from the Baptist Church in Wyoming. And so my parents really enjoyed their company, and after a little while, they decided that they would leave the United Church and they'd begin to attend the Baptist Church. And they brought me out to the Baptist Church for the first couple of years, and I was starting to get into my teenage years, and you know how that is. You get your own mind, or else you think you have a mind. And they started to drag me out to church. Literally kicking and screaming. No joke about that. I did everything I could to make sure that they would not bring me out the next Sunday, every Sunday. I did that. I was disruptive in the church services. I hated going out to church. Truth be, I'm not even sure that the Baptist minister who was there was actually converted. But I just hated church, period. At that point, I got into high school, and I started to realize, you know, that it's not popular to go to church. you know, cool kids don't really have much to do with that. You live for the moment. And so this was another reason that I didn't want to have anything to do with church. It just wasn't cool. Well, one of my best friends, he was a believer, and he and I hung out all the time in high school, and he kept inviting me out to youth group, and I didn't want to go to youth group because it was a church thing, and he'd invite me every single week. And so finally, just to shut him up, I said, okay, I'll come out just this once. And I did okay in high school. I was the class clown. Everybody knew who I was. I was a nice guy. I wasn't a jerk or anything like that. So I went out to youth group, and I thought it would be the same thing. You know, you'd be the funny guy, you'd do crazy things, and everybody would like you. So I went out to youth group, and that's how I was. I put on that front, and I quickly made a lot of friends at the church, and thought, okay, well, that's the same formula. So, you know, that's good. I had a good time, and I had such a good time, actually, that it was a games night or something. I remember being pulled around on carpets and whipping these girls around on carpets, one girl ripping her toenail off because it got caught in the volleyball net hole. And we had a great time. So he said, well, except that girl. So I thought, oh wow, this is not like church that I'm used to. So he asked me to come again, and I sure enough I went again because it was just a lot of fun. I began to go and go and go every time they had one of those nights, and eventually I made good friends with a lot of the people. And I began to also go out to the Bible studies that were during the week. After all, the games nights were fun, and the Bible study nights, they turned out to be pretty fun too. And something, I began to notice something a little different from high school, where you act crazy and you become popular. There were a wide spectrum of kids at this youth group. It wasn't like high school, where you hung out with the crowds that you were cool with. There were kids from all, you know, social statuses, I guess you would say, and every one of them got along with each other. They all acted like friends, and I began to realize that, you know, I didn't need to be this guy that I was at high school if I was going to get along at the youth group, because there was something different about it. I don't think that was something I noticed conscientiously, but it did begin to sink in. And I began to, like I said, to attend these Bible studies, and there was someone there that I began to notice, and it was a girl. And so as I went to these Bible studies, I always would try to, you know, find a place to sit, and somehow it would always be right beside her. And as we opened our Bibles up to study, the youth group leader had given me an NIV, student Bible. I'd always noticed that her Bible was marked up. It was underlined a lot with red ink. And I thought, you know, if I'm ever going to ask this girl out, my Bible's going to have to look like that. Because otherwise, she's not going to pay any attention to me. So that's what I set out to do. I set out to make my Bible a little bit red. But I thought, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to actually read it. And I'm going to underline things that make sense. And that's what happened. I started to read my Bible, and I imagine the youth group, the youth pastor there, he probably gave me the right books to read or something, and I began to read it. And I also began to attend church, because I was starting to make a good group of friends at this youth group, and I began to hear the gospel preached every week, which was helpful. But honestly, I think it was through the reading of the scriptures that God opened my eyes. Which is one of the questions that was asked in Sunday school this morning. Can we understand our Bibles if God hasn't saved us? I think the answer is not fully, but I think that God does, he still does speak to us through the Word, whether we're saved or not. And I began to understand that I needed Christ. that I was in a heap of trouble. If God was to return at any moment, I knew that I wouldn't be going to heaven. And this began to, it began to bother me greatly. So that night after night, and it was in bed, as I lay in bed at night that I did all my thinking, waiting to fall asleep, it began to really gnaw at me. It began to become the only thing I could think about as I lay in bed at night. To the point that one night, it bothered me so much, I realized this is the night. I can't run any longer. I can't deny Christ anymore. And I got out of bed, and I remember getting on my knees and surrendering my life to Christ. And amen. And I don't remember what day it was, but I remember the moment. And I think I got up out of bed, and I laid back in bed and went right to sleep. And that was it. My fears were no longer there. I went back to high school, and I knew that this change was real. And it didn't take me long at all to become very serious about Christ. God really grabbed hold of me. After all, I was already kind of an intense guy in high school. I'd do anything. And when you have that kind of personality, it happened very quickly at school. No more seeking to go to parties and this crazy lifestyle and being a real clown in class. Everything had to change, and I knew that. And it did. Over the course of a week or two, it was just day and night. So much so that many of the people who were my friends began to hear the gospel, and they heard it in the full. And I lost a lot of friends really fast. You begin to realize in a time like that that these people who you thought were your friends and whose favor you worked so hard to gain by just being a nut, it's just for nothing. The only friend that really stood by me was that one friend who invited me out to church and those who were in the church. Now, mind you, there was an element of this that was just my, just being uncouth, being untactful. I was so zealous and passionate that not literally, but all next thing to it, I was almost hitting people over the head with the scripture. And it was a tough year for me to lose all those friends, to lose that kind of popularity, and it was very depressing, and I got really, really depressed. But over the course of the next year or so, God worked in my life to, I think maybe not necessarily tone me down, but maybe make me a little more understanding. And over time, people at high school who were my friends before, they began to see, this is the same guy. He's changed, but for the better. And I think, people began to notice that kind of witness, and it was wonderful. Got to share the gospel with a lot of people, and in a way that wasn't just, dumb or just foolish. When I graduated high school, I didn't know what I was going to do. My friends were heading off to Trinity Western University, and I didn't have the grades to get into university. I didn't want to do another year of high school. So I thought, well, I better go off to Bible college or something, one that doesn't require all these the higher level courses in high school. I got by on mercy marks. I mean, when I got a lot of 50s, and I didn't deserve the 50s. They were just, get this kid out of here, I think. So I went off for a year to Briarcrest Bible College, and I was not ready for it at all. And I didn't have an interest in academics, and it was just a, in a lot of ways, a kind of a disastrous year. I'm sure God had his purpose in me going out there, but I came back thinking, okay, well, what am I going to do? I liked cars, so I went into school to be a diesel mechanic, and I enjoyed that. It was good. I went to Fanshawe College to learn that. But while I was living in London, I was staying with a pastor named Brian Robinson, whom some of you know. He's a really, really great fella. And I was living with him and his wife, and I was attending Sovereign Grace Church down in Sarnia, where Glenn Tomlinson is pastoring now. And week after week, I'd go back to Sovereign Grace, and I'd be teaching the adult Sunday school class. As I grew in my faith, I began to really, really study God's Word. Just loved to study God's Word till all hours of the morning. And it was just a couple of months before I graduated that I began to realize, because people had been telling me, you know, you need to think about going into some sort of ministry or teaching or something like this. And I was hearing that, but I mean, just the idea of that is daunting. I mean, you listen to that qualifications list. Who in the world would, you know, not be scared by that sort of thing? And then it was about a couple of months before I graduated with my diesel mechanics papers that I began to realize, you know, I think God is calling me to some sort of ministry. And living with Brian Robinson, I mean, that was a huge catalyst as well, because he's just a wonderful teacher and a godly example as a minister and a man. So that's what I resolved to do. I graduated from Fanshawe, ready to go into diesel mechanics, and I enrolled next year to go into the University of Western Ontario. And as soon as I was done that, I was going to go on to do my MDiv, and then I was going to go on to do my PhD so that I could teach theology. So I went to Western, went into philosophy, which is, in my opinion, probably the lion's den if you were going to go to university. Boy, that was quite a year. 3 years. I grew tremendously just in those classrooms, in that secular setting. It's not a myth that the university hates Christianity. Almost every one of my classes I had, it seemed almost every professor I had it in for Christianity. Which was great for me, because I had been prepared at a wonderful church at Sovereign Grace and had done a lot of good reading up to that point, and that was where I really got to sharpen my teeth. I was the guy in the class who would stand up. As soon as one of those pastors would, far from it, professors would challenge Christianity, boy, to me that was like I was a bee and they were honey on a stick. And except I wouldn't go and eat it. I'd go with my little stinger right in. And it was a great learning experience. Not only that, the students there who were at odds with me as a Christian. Not only did it help me to learn better about the Christian faith and be able to counter the world's arguments, but I think it really helped me to understand as well how this world needs to be engaged. The wisdom, quote unquote, of the world, and how futile it is, but how everybody esteems it in such a glorious way, and how that needs to be tackled with a lot of tact and especially a lot of love. Because there is, as much as the academics want to talk about political correctness and showing love, there's very little love there. If you're a Christian going in there, you have a great opportunity not just to present the greatest arguments that can never be refuted, but to show the kind of love that they'll never find in a setting like that. But it was a wonderful time of growing. I still remember, I think my favorite day at university was probably the most difficult day that I had in the classrooms, and just felt beat down. And then one night I was walking out of the hall, it was about 10 or 10:30 at night, out of the philosophy building, and there was a piano in one of the rooms, and somebody was playing. What is it? What's your favorite song again? Great is Thy Faithfulness. And I heard that coming out of the room. And I remember going in there and just sitting in there and thinking, Great is Thy Faithfulness. Yeah, that was a gift. After graduating from Western, I went down to Kentucky to Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And again, another great experience, not so much learning to sharpen your teeth, but just learning more about the scriptures, how to read the Bible, and put it all together. I can't say much except that it was a great experience. Got to meet some wonderful Christian leaders from around the world, and spend lots of good time with some of those guys, and I guess just that was the rest after Western, I guess. Laying down and just taking it all in. After that, I came back up here to Canada. I got a summer job as a park ranger, and the season had ended, and my roommate from Southern said, man, you need to get married. You need to find a wife. And he said, there's this great dating website that you need to check out. And I thought, dating website? Do I look like I'm that desperate? And I said, I'll never go on there. Forget it. Well, the season had ended. Labor Day weekend had come and gone, and I was working nights. And I decided, okay, well, I'll go on this website. I was in the office just sitting there. And lo and behold, that was the website I got on first 2 weeks for free. that was the website. See, that's how they hook you. But I got on the website, and that's where I met my wife. I was on there for a while. She was on there for one day. And she wrote an email saying, it was just a one line saying, I think it said, you have a nice smile. And I thought, well, she knows what she's talking about. And so we started to type back and forth for a number of months. And then I flew over to Kyrgyzstan to meet her. She was, her name's Regina, spelled like Regina, and I thought that's where she was from. And I thought, man, Saskatchewan, oh, I had a bad experience out there once before. And I thought, even though she seems nice, that's still a really long way. And I got confused. I didn't realize that she was from Kyrgyzstan, which is on the other side of the world. But anyway, so we had, I was hooked by that point with her conversation. Just could tell she was a wonderful Christian girl. I flew over there a few months after we started talking on there. I met her and brought her back to Canada, where she spent a few months, and we ended up getting married here. And so the Lord knew what he was doing in there, in that situation. So, if you're on one of those websites, looking for someone, don't worry, it does work. It can work. If somebody says, you're crazy for going on there, say, well, look at Noel. I might say, yeah, well, he's crazy too. But anyway, it does turn out. After that, I continued on with my studies, doing a THM at Toronto Baptist Seminary, which I'm still in the process of completing. And until a couple of years ago, I was still certain that I was probably going to go into or teaching ministry. I suppose this kind of runs over into the first question that you have for me. You want me to kind of answer that now? I can answer it now. Yeah. And I had begun making myself available for preaching, doing pulpit supply. In fact, at Sovereign Grace, when Kirk Wellum left and we were waiting a few years for Glenn Tomlinson to come, myself and Roger Fellows kind of took up the bulk of the preaching there. And I noticed, even just doing pulpit supply, that there was a certain connection that I began to make with people in the church. And the heart that I developed for people was very intense, even so much so that when Glenn came, it felt like I was kind of divorcing the people, almost. And I began to realize, I think, for the first time, that God has given me a heart for the people in the church. And there was a tremendous amount of care that is really hard to describe. Tremendous amount of love that's really, really hard to describe that I began to feel. And that was the first time that I started to think, you know, God might be pointing me in another direction. I think he still, and I've never stopped thinking this, I think teaching is still very much a part of what he wants me to do. But over the years, the last couple of years in particular, I've been feeling a specific love for the church and people in the church. And not just in some kind of a leadership capacity, but simply just loving the church. Like I said this morning, coming here, every time we come here, every time I go to any church that you know is like this, I feel like I'm coming home to my family. And I think this was God's pointing, God telling us, you do have these teaching gifts, but I think I want you in the church. And that's the pointing that I began to feel. When I came out here, I remember for the first time to preach at this very church, two people said to me afterwards, you know, we're thinking of an associate pastor. I think that was over 3 years ago now. You were one of them. Wouldn't that be something? I thought, yeah, that would be something. But then I didn't hear about it for a couple of years. But the thought was still there. God was already beginning I was already beginning to feel that call to the local church in a pastoral sort of a role. Well, this last summer, I got a phone call from this church, and they told me, "Oh, we're looking for an associate pastor. Would you like to consider it?" And I put in my application, and along with a lot of prayer, not just on our parts, but I know your parts as well, for which we thank you guys tremendously. That was such a great assurance to us as we were home praying. I'd always say, you know, they're praying too. And things progressed. We had the interview in September, and that went well. And all signs seemed to point here. Everyone I spoke to, every pastor that I spoke to, friend said this would be a wonderful, wonderful opportunity. And we prayed and prayed to God, God, make it very clear to us. This is where you want us. There's been nothing that's come along that has pointed to the contrary. Everything has pointed, has pointed here. Now, that being said, there is a vote tonight, and we are prepared, and we understand that if it's not God's will, then it won't be the case. I mean, that would be the biggest sign of all, right? But if it is, I think it would just be, I mean, it's the biggest, sign. Yes, you are to be here after all the other small ones that we've received. Anyway, that kind of rolls over into answering the first question. But my testimony going right into the call. Yeah, and I will turn it over to my lovely wife now to tell you her testimony. Thanks.
Hi, everyone. You'll see my face get really red by the end of this. I'm not a public speaker, but I would like to share my testimony with you. I was born in Kyrgyzstan, which used to be part of the Soviet Union. Born in a kind of atheist / Muslim family. My dad is an atheist. If you ask him, he'll say that he is Muslim, but that's just like saying Christian in this culture when you don't really go to church or do anything. My mom will say she's a Muslim, and from early on we were taught to say, to memorize Arabic prayers. So every night before going to bed, we said prayers. Every night after meal, we went Amin in Arabic. So I have two brothers. My brothers and I, in 1996, started going to, well, we met this American missionaries from Campus Crusade, and I've always had a longing in my heart to know God. So I came up to my mom and I said, Mom, I want to go to the mosque or something. I need to find God. And she said, well, women aren't supposed to go to the mosque. It's only for men. So why don't you wait, and I'll have a man from the mosque come and speak to you or pray with you or something. And I've been waiting, and it didn't happen. So one day I started watching TV, and they started airing Billy Graham shows and Joyce Meyer and all these other television evangelists that were just great. And they were sending out also free literature, so I signed up for free literature. And that's where I really heard the gospel in the name of Jesus for the first time. Now, where I'm from, most people are Muslims, but there's also a lot of Russians, so there's a lot of like Russian Orthodox churches around where they worship like saints, and they worship like pictures, icons, and they kiss the hand of the Pope, the Russian Pope. So I also started going there because I was really curious, but not finding anything there. My brothers and I met these wonderful missionaries from Campus Crusade, who showed us the Jesus film. I'm sure you've heard of it. It's very, very, very quite spread where I'm from. So I saw this movie for the first time, and I didn't realize, but I guess I started going to church on Sunday mornings and not telling my mom where I was going, because becoming a Christian in a Muslim culture is a very it's a huge shame. Like it's basically becoming a traitor in the eyes of your relatives, friends, and religion. So my brothers and I started sneaking out to church on Sunday mornings, we became Christians in 1996, both my brothers and I, and it was so great that God saved, and that now I have Christian siblings, but non-Christian family, non-Christian parents, but we still pray for them. So one day I come home, and my mom is really crying, and she said, what have you done? What did you do to us? This is so shameful. Somebody went and told her that we were going to church, and that we brought this big shame on our family. So in a few days, my mom and dad decided that they're not going to let us go to church anymore, and they found a whole bunch of Christian literature in our home that we were hiding. So we had to throw that out, and for a couple of years, we couldn't go to church. My older brother still somehow managed to go, but I listened to my parents, and this was the time when God was the closest to me. It was the time of when he really showed me that, you know, the Bible that I had in my bathroom was enough, I didn't, like, even though I was separated from all my Christian friends, that God still cared for me, that he loved me. This was, for me, the time of tremendous growth. And I've never, like, had a more, I would say, intimate time with God than those 2 years, for sure. After a few years, my mom and dad started opening up, and because for them, they thought that becoming Christian means you're going to start stealing stuff, you're going to start smoking, drinking. They didn't know what Protestant Christians were like. So after seeing the change that, you know, that my brothers and I have had, they said, well, you know, we've been fighting you for all these years. We can't do anything about it. Just do whatever you want. You can, you know, read the Bible, but just don't tell the relatives. Like, don't speak openly about it. So we were so thankful and grateful for this opportunity to be able to attend church again. And I, at that point, I went to study in the States for a year. I was an exchange student, and I was 16. And I came to church, and I was like, wow, like there's such freedom in the States to go to church. You don't have to be afraid of persecution or even your family finding out that you're in the church. But at the same time, I was heartbroken because I saw a lot of people that went to church didn't really mean. So it was a more cultural thing in Texas. That's where I was. That was definitely an eye-opener. Like in Kyrgyzstan, if you go to church, most of the time you probably go because you really want to, because you want a fellowship, because you know you want to grow, you want to hear the sermon. That was still a great year, a year of growth and meeting lots of encouraging Christians. There were lots of wonderful stories that happened to me there as well. When I came back, my mom was at the point where she was like, you know, we can't stop you doing anything. Like, now you're free to marry even a Christian guy if you want. So that was a great that was a great discovery for me, because before that, you know, she said that, like, if you ever marry a Christian, I'm just going to die, and, like, I'm gonna be, you're not going to be my daughter. So when Noel proposed, when we met, she was more than happy. Her first question was, is he a Christian? I said, yeah. She said, that's wonderful, go for it. Because she's seen the testimony of Christians in Kyrgyzstan, and she's seen that they're not as evil as she thought they were. That on the opposite, they're people that love, that take care of other believers, and my parents have changed their view of Christianity so much, and my husband and I pray for them as much as we can every day, and I believe that, you know, God can speak even to their hearts of cold. My dad believes in UFO and science fiction, and my mom believes in Islam. My brothers now, my older brother is going to Vietnam to be a missionary in February with his family, and my twin brother, I'm a twin, so he's in Kyrgyzstan still, applying to come to Canada as a skilled worker, so I hope to have some family over here. That would be just great for me. What else? It's wonderful to be here. Thank you so much. My testimony is short.
As I mentioned earlier, we're going to be asking Noel some questions. He did answer the first question already, which was to describe his calling to ministry. You've touched on the second and third questions, but I'm going to ask them anyway, just in case you had any other points you wanted to add. Why do you feel you were called specifically here to Newcastle Fellowship Baptist Church?
Well, from the get-go, I think, as I had already touched on, it was about 3 years ago. This was the very first place that kind of sparked, a feeling of confirmation in me that God maybe was calling me to the pastorate. Secondly, again, you know, every time we came to preach here, or I came to preach here, it was a feeling of family. This really did feel like family. I'm just pausing here because I'm trying to think if there are any other churches where I've had such an intense feeling of that. I don't think that there are. So that was a great part of the confirmation too. Just a loving church. You guys have loved me since I've come to preach for that first time. When I've come with my wife, you've loved my family. You've loved us without even really knowing us all that much. I just get that sense from talking to Jacques and Bruce, and just the amount of prayer that you guys are praying over us, and we feel that love as well. In addition, I've known Jacques, as he said this morning, for a number of years. I think from the first time that I met Jacques, I just felt a very strong bond in Christ. As you all know, this man's enthusiasm is extremely infectious. And when I bring friends out to the Toronto Pastors Fellowship, I say, okay, when we go out for lunch, you need to sit across from Jacques. Because you'll come away like an Energizer bunny. And it's true. I really value what you have here as a pastor, the man that you have here as a pastor, just as an inspiration to me. I look forward to the opportunity. I can't think of a better place to start in vocational ministry than, number one, under Jacques. But I've gotten to know you too, Bruce, and some of the other elders here. I talked this morning about surrounding yourself with a winning team. I don't think I need to say any more there. I don't want you guys to start feeling weird because I'm saying all this stuff about you. But I think there's a love here that that we really value. When I think of a place to come, not only where I can come to minister, but where I can raise a family along with you. There aren't too many places where I would rather do that. I think of our little girls, and I think of my wife, and the fellowship that she would receive, and just the love that our daughters would receive. That plays into it as well. That's just a wonderful feeling to be able to look out here as I talk right now and see all the smiles and the heads nodding, yes, we will love you. that's a great, great feeling, and we love your family. I have a real heart for student ministry and working with young people. The last church that we were at, that was I was heavily involved in that, and I just love it. I'm excited that there's a university that's nearby, and there are so many university students, and teenagers and college aged, because I don't know, maybe it just helps me feel like I'm still grasping onto some of my youth or something. But this church has that going for it, and I think it's a great place to enter into vocational ministry for sure. Hopefully, it'll go on for years and years. Okay. Yeah.
What would you say are your primary areas of ministry interest and giftedness? I mean, you touched on that a bit too, but again, just to give you some more opportunity to expand.
Yeah. Well, without a doubt in my mind, my primary gifts would be preaching and teaching, number one. Those are things that I just love to do. I can't get enough of either of them. I was talking to Jacques earlier this week about the possibility of teaching, and he's like, is that okay? And I said, man, is that okay? Are you kidding? That's what I live for. I love to study the Word. I love to study theology, and the only thing I think I love more than that is being able to impart that to others. I remember putting as a status on Facebook not too long ago, I was preparing for a sermon. It's like digging down for a massive buried treasure that you're going to share with everyone. The only unfortunate thing is that with every shovelful, you get a load of gold coins. And unfortunately, those are the ones you can't share. But the treasure at the bottom, you can. I get to collect the gold coins. But those are my two primary areas of giftedness. I would say shepherding as well, whatever that entails, caring for the people who I might be responsible for. yeah, I don't have a lot of wisdom, but the wisdom that God gives me, I love to see it put to action in the lives of others that I, you know, that can glean from it. So, yeah.
Just to carry on with what you were saying, during our interview, you mentioned how you do, you work with the College and Careers Age, and you really enjoy the apologetics part. And so part of the teaching you'd be referring to would be even one-on-one as well, right? Would that be
fair? Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, that's something I enjoy doing. It's a real delight to just meet one-on-one and all the questions. Because everybody's going through different things in their life all the time, right? I mean, you can preach on general topics and teach on general topics, but yeah, the meeting on one-on-one is, I mean, it's a joy because you get to not only learn what they're going through and pray with them, but teach to specific issues. I mean, that sharpens everybody, I mean, myself included.
I'm going to jump to number five here. How would you provide effective pastoral leadership here at Newcastle Fellowship Baptist Church in your areas of interest and giftedness?
It's weird when you stand up here beside me. I feel like we're going to present an Oscar or something.
I left the envelopes over there.
Yeah. well, this was of all the questions, this was probably the most difficult to answer. And I was telling you this morning, just because I don't really have a map of the land yet. It's like a thorough understanding of exactly what's going on in here. So I suppose some general answers and some disciplines that I practice would be the best way to answer it. First and foremost, prayer and study of the Word. I mean, that always has to be primary. As I sat at home thinking about the opportunity here at Newcastle and what a day might look like, the number one thing is every day start the day out with prayer and reading the Word and study. I think that's probably the most that I would, the thing that would be, that would enable me to contribute the most. Just keeping those a daily discipline. Working with the youth and kind of overseeing, as you said, the youth programs, small groups, that kind of thing. I look forward to developing different curricula, seeing what's out there, what's offered in the world of Christianity in terms of good teaching. I know that there's a lot of good stuff coming out of Piper's Church, and look forward to implementing some of that. But in addition, developing curriculum that's specific to this church. I mean, there are so many good resources. We're just talking about going through the systematic theology of Grudem before the service. Basic teaching about how to interpret our Bibles better, how to put it together, and to learn to not only apply it to our lives, but to the lives of everyone that we're talking with, whether they be Christian or non-Christian. So developing that kind of stuff and participating in it myself. I mean, that's probably the thing I look forward to most of all is those opportunities that I'm going to have to teach, whether they be in Sunday school or whether they be for Bible study or speaking at youth group now and then, or whatever it may be. And the same goes for the development of small groups. Just basically planning good curriculum. I look forward to meeting with small group leaders and just understanding the dynamics that are going on in the church and how those can best be served. So that we can, even though there's small groups, it's still, you know, those small groups still work together to make us one body. And thrive as a body. So this village of Newcastle and Bowmanville, so that none of them are without hearing the gospel. I think this church is capable of that, taking the gospel to every single person in this community. One of the things that I really want to emphasize, and it's not because I don't think it's being done here, I've already sensed the heart for it, but is evangelism. Evangelism is something that has always been... Ever since I was converted in high school, I remember walking in the doors of high school one morning, just looking at the hall, looking down the hall, and bursting out in tears because of the people who were lost. I think evangelism is something that really needs to be stressed, both here and a vision, a proper vision for missions. That's something else. I mean, we can go on and on. There's so many things, but a proper vision for missions. Again, this is a church that is capable of tons of missionaries being sent out from this congregation. There's a statistic I just heard not too long ago that 1.8 out of every 1,000 Christians in North America become missionaries. That needs to change, and that can change here. Conferences, looking at good conferences that are offered. There aren't many in Canada. Maybe that can change in Newcastle. Maybe we can start a gospel coalition or Together for the Gospel right here in little Newcastle. But getting the church plugged in to conferences to go to. And then I think probably what I see, what I find the most rewarding, I know I found this the most rewarding at the youth group that I was leading at the last church, was the development of Christian leaders, both guys and girls. Developing young men for ministry, preaching, the word. We're already talking about that at lunch today. And developing people to be missionaries. Those are just some of the things. A couple.
You have read our doctrinal position here at Newcastle. You've read our constitution and our doctrinal distinctive paper. Please comment on your position in relation to our church's theological stance.
Okay. This was the easiest question to answer after the hardest question. My position in relation. It's pretty hard for both of us to stand in the exact same spot at one time. So that's my position. We're standing in the same spot. Yeah. I love it. I love your church's doctrinal statement. I love the distinctives for Newcastle Fellowship Baptist Church. Every single one of them I read, I was like, yes, that's great. So that's my answer. Yeah.
And we did go over that quite thoroughly during the interview with you and your paper and your resume and so on as well. So
yeah.
I can back that up. He is quite excited.
Yeah, it's great. It's a great doctrinal statement. If you haven't read it, read it. If you haven't read it this week, read it.
Having a young family can make it difficult to balance family life and ministry. Describe how you intend to ensure a balance between your personal life, family responsibilities, and the demands of the ministry here at church.
Yeah, this is one that I almost felt like during the interview I gave kind of a cop-out answer because I said, you know, I can't imagine having a problem with that. And the truth is, I still can't imagine having a problem with that. It almost sounds bad to put it this way, but my biggest distraction is my family. I just love hanging out with my wife and girls. And I don't say that as a bad thing. I think that's, if that's a fault, that's a really good fault. But I do love spending time with them. I guess if I would have to give a safeguard, one of the things that I want to establish as a routine is for my wife and I to get out at least one night every couple of weeks, where we can just spend time, the two of us, basically a date night. So that we never, ever lose sight of that. I've seen too many problems where not just have people become distracted with work, but they've become distracted with kids, so that when kids leave the nest, there's no marriage left. I want to really work at keeping that core. So establishing that, every night, my wife and I, we spend an hour to an hour and a half or so just praying together and reading the Word. And I find that not only a good time for just getting to know God and making God the center of our relationship, but often that's the time that we talk as well. So as long as we keep those quiet times together important, and they are a very high priority to us, I think that there will always be good communication that will happen, a good time that we spend together. Now, I know my own propensity to overload myself with work. My wife knows this as well. I have a really hard time saying no to anything. I'm just laughing because I'm just thinking of Regina saying, you got to learn to say no. I will count on this church as well to hold me accountable in that regard. Count on the elders to say, you take a break here. If I begin, or if any of you get that sense that I'm losing focus on priority. So I would have to say that short of our devotional times each night, I'd be counting on the church here to say, look, Musket, slow down, man. Yeah. Spend some time with your wife. Yeah.
And here's the last question before we open the floor for questions from the congregation. Are you and your family prepared to move to Newcastle to join our ministry in this community?
Yes. You spend all these times coming up with illustrations that might win people, it's kind of funny in a sermon, but you just have to say yes. Yeah. Start every sermon with that.
Is this one on? You good? Okay. Bob Abbott had his hand up first. Bob, go ahead.
Evangelism. That was something dear to my heart, too. But Wikipedia phones you up one day and says, Noel, where does the Bible say the Christian gospel begins? What would you say?
Sorry.
Wikipedia
calls up and says, sorry, I was talking when you said it again. So,
they're making an entry for the gospel in Wikipedia, and they ask you, what does the Bible say about where the Christian gospel begins? What would you say?
Where the Christian gospel begins. In terms of evangelism. So, sorry. Maybe I'm just nervous, but I'm all confused right now. Where does it begin? I'd say it begins here. Is that what you mean? Like it begins here in your hometown with your neighbors? Or do you mean where does it begin in the Bible?
I was just thinking of Romans chapter 1. Paul says, that's all.
Okay.
I'm not ashamed of the gospel. And he begins, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven.
Yeah.
But your favorite verse?
Oh, my favorite verse. I have to say my favorite verse is probably, Romans 8:28, where it talks about God works in all things for the good of those who love him. That's the greatest assurance for me. That doesn't really answer your question about where the gospel begins, though. You might have to reword that question. I'm so sorry that I can't understand what you're asking there. Oh, yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I would say the gospel, absolutely. I mean, it begins with a realization of where you stand before God. That's where the gospel begins for me. So when I'm evangelizing, that's where the gospel began for me. As I talked about, realizing that I'm in trouble with God. So when I'm evangelizing, I love the Way of the Master resources. I'm not sure their understanding of the role of the law is exactly right, but I think the point is their point is dead on. We need to understand first where we stand in relation to God. When people go out and say, you know, hey, this is how you evangelize, you share God's love with them. That's where you start. I say, no, it's not where you start, because God has no love for them as they stand. He hates sin. And if sin is our fundamental characteristic, well, what does that say about how he feels about us? You see, I don't think God, and this may get me in a bit of trouble, I probably shouldn't say this on when I'm kind of in an interview process, maybe. But I would say that that an unconverted person, God does not love that person. God hates the sinner. God doesn't send people that he loves to hell. So I think that we need to make people realize, look, you're a sinner. You're in trouble. You violated God's law. Whether you know it or not, you violated God's law, and God's wrath is upon you. And give them a sense of that. I wouldn't just go in there and say it like that right away. But we need them to understand that God's wrath is upon them, and it's only in that context that you can really begin to understand God's love. Because if you have somebody who's shaking their fist at God, or worse, really giving God the finger, basically, why in the world would he accept you? It's pure love. That has to be the context. You're a rightful recipient of the wrath of God. Then you can understand love. Yeah. Does that answer better? Okay. All right.
I've enjoyed this evening. I thank you for your honesty. I am really appreciative of how well your wife has mastered the English language. But what you just said now, I believe, is a little off base in that Christ came to this earth to die for sinners.
Yes.
And if he didn't love us enough to come to the earth to die for sinners, then I don't quite understand that last answer. Okay? No, I'm not done. Okay. Yeah, okay, thank you. I know that you speak well. You were a good speaker this morning. I enjoyed that, and you've been before. So my thought was, I was meeting with one of the board members here just a few days ago, and I said, you see, the place is full on a Sunday night. I know there's a few more here than usually is on a Sunday night. But you can't find a place in the parking lot either. So those guys that are plowing snow, take some snow off that grass back there so there's more room to park. But the fact of the matter is, maybe we need a third service on Sunday. Maybe. Okay. How do I question this? When you talked about evangelism a few weeks ago, one of the young people got up and said, we're going to start a bus ministry. We're going to try this outreach type thing. And I think your ministry might well fit in to what we're talking about, encouraging these people. And I guess the question is, I really don't know whether or not two people being able to preach without having opportunity is maybe the best way to look at it, without having different ideas, and I know you'll work them out.
Yeah. Well, the first thing, I knew that would raise some questions about how we reconcile Christ loving sinners enough to die for them with the fact that God is at enmity, which is another word for has hatred toward sinners. The fact of the matter is, at the end of the day, I think we need to keep in mind Okay, God is a God of love. I think that is his primary attribute.
Some would argue that, but I think it is. But what we need to remember is who is the primary subject of God's love. It isn't us. It's God, first and foremost. Okay? So whenever God is appealed to, for example, in the Old Testament, to do something to save his people, nobody ever appeals to God to save his people solely on the basis of his love for the people. You'll notice time and time again, those appeals end with, for your glory. Do this for your glory. Or the nations will look at you, God, if you abandon your people, and they'll say, where is their God? The appeal's always to God's own glory, right? This is why I believe God saves sinners. It isn't primarily because he has a love for us. Secondarily, he has a love for us. Primarily, he has a love for himself. And he wants to be magnified. His glory, he wants his glory to be magnified. I think this is why he saves sinners, first and foremost. So that when people look, and when we get to heaven, and we look at ourselves and say, man, why in the world did he save me? I did everything against him. I was a rebel. I hated him. I spat in his face. I know I can say this about myself, like I said, Sunday after Sunday, being dragged to the church, just making a mockery of the whole thing. We'll look back and we'll say, why did he save us? It was primarily for his glory. And we'll bring him glory because of that. Now, secondarily, there's a couple ways in which he loves us. I think he loves all of mankind in the sense that he simply loves those who are created in his image, and he loves all of his creation. That's why the scripture can talk about God being grieved when people sin against him, and even being grieved when he destroys people. It's because he has a general love for all of his creation. Why he adopts us, why he chooses to love us, apart from magnifying himself, that's a mystery that I can't answer. And I don't think Paul can answer it either. I think that's where he takes us in Romans chapter 9 when he says, when Paul talks about some vessels have been created for destruction and some have been created for noble purposes. And then Paul pretends he's his questioner, his interlocutor, and says, well, you might ask, you know, who are we to blame then if God set it up this way? I mean, how can we be held accountable for something like this? Paul says, who are you to question God? So Paul doesn't even know, I don't think, why he extends that love to us. I mean, it is arguable that God could glorify himself in other ways. He's chosen to do it this way, first and foremost. And I think that brings us to, you know, where I can vouch for that answer, that God does indeed, at the end of the day, hate the sinner. Nevertheless, he does change the heart of the sinner so that the sinner is an object that he can love. Why? I don't know. It is for his glory, but why else? I'm not quite sure. I'm not quite sure. So yes, Christ does love us enough to give his life for us. I don't know why. It's to glorify God first and foremost, but other than that, I have no clue why. I have no clue why he loved me. I wouldn't love me. I would have destroyed me. If I created Play-Doh figurines and started biting my feet and torturing my children and that kind of stuff, I'd stomp on them. I don't know. Anyway, I hope that answers the first part of the question. The second part, maybe my hearing's going, but I didn't. It was about two services or two speakers. What was that, Bruce? Sorry.
We could perhaps address it even discussion in the meeting afterwards, but Lyle has a concern about there being two preaching pastors, as he sees it, and would be concerned that we'd be hiring you as a pastor to preach when, in fact, we have Jocko.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd just be doing pulpit supply. I'd jump at the chance to preach anytime. But it'd probably primarily be for pulpit supply. Yeah. So Pastor Jacques, he's still the main preaching man. I've heard him preach, so that's a good thing.
Any other questions? Ready?
Yes, I'm going to be a little daring and ask you a personal question. I don't want you to answer according to what the Bible says, and I don't want you to answer according to what you expect people to say.
Okay.
I want you to answer according to your heart, and only your own heart, because only your heart can tell this answer. I would like you to describe your wife.
Oh, okay. Phew. My wife. She's wonderful. She's a godly woman, although she doesn't know how godly she is. I think that I'm not saying this just to sound good. This is my wife. She's incredibly supportive and brutally honest. But that's good, because that's supportive in my mind. She's a woman who I think understands what it is to be a Christian wife. I'm not sure that we understand that concept so well in North America. And perhaps it's partly because of the culture that she was brought up in. But she's a woman who I think she works very hard to support me and what I want to do for God. I think she's a woman who supports me simply in her gifts that she doesn't entirely realize are her gifts. She doesn't think she has many gifts. I hope that doesn't embarrass you to say that. But you just watch her in action. And she's got a lot of spiritual gifts. Wonderful at hospitality. She's got a huge heart. People, and she'll tell you that. She loves children. She loves those who are poor. She's a great mom, although again, I don't know if she thinks she's that great of a mom, but she is a great mom. I don't know, I love her. I love her a lot. Sorry for taking so long to think here. I think she's a woman who doesn't realize how incredibly God has gifted her. And we even spoke about that a bit this afternoon. I mean, she has no idea how she could be the wife of a pastor. She doesn't feel qualified for it. And again, really, are any of us qualified to do service to God? But I think if there's one person in the house that is fit for their role, it's her. She's far more fit for ministry than I am, I think. I mean, God's given me certain gifts, but I've learned them. Hers are innate. Yeah, I don't know. That's kind of my answer. I think you can get a sense of the rest of my answer. I hope I didn't say anything that was embarrassing to you, but yeah. Did you want me to say more? Or? Now that's a question that makes me nervous. Yeah. 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 You know, as far as the ministry component goes, she is a woman who, like I said, incredibly supportive. I think she sees her role as supporting her husband to do the work of God. I think that's primarily how she sees herself fulfilling God's role for her. Making ministry as effective as we can, primarily through that. I mean, she has her own gifts. She leads a female Bible study in London, and of course raises the children, but which are all incredibly important. But I think she sees that as her primary role and calling. Yeah. You can come and speak now. Yeah, to that, I guess. Might as well.
Well, I think he's got a huge heart for people. Like, that's his biggest thing. In the church, where, like, he's always wanting to know everything about everyone. So he's got a heart for people. He's extremely caring, I think. He's a great dad, and he's also... accepts me as I am, which is great because he overlooks a lot of my faults. He's growing up in a Russian culture. You know, guys don't help around the house, so he does dishes, he changes kids' diapers, which is such a gift for me. I never thought I would have a husband that does that.
Come on, think of something. Oh, see, if you marry a woman from a Muslim background where the guys really don't have anything to do with the kids or family, you always come out looking good. Yeah.
Yes, Noel. Hit a raw nerve there.
Sorry?
I say you hit a raw nerve there mm-hmm. when responding to a question a little while ago. My purpose of this clarification isn't so much to cause any kind of dissension on the issue, mm-hmm. but, you know, so often we've grown up in evangelical quarters over the years with expressions like God hates the sin but loves the sinner, and we've come to understand that that God's love, you know, scarcely would anyone die for a righteous man, let alone a good man, but he commended this love to us that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us, and we're constantly affirmed of how great that love was. Christmas, we celebrate all those things. So I guess the clarification I'm asking is, when you allude to the fact of God hating the sinner, are you saying in the sense that God hates the sin but loves the sinner, but it's to his glory when that sinner repents and is drawn by God's grace to receive Christ, his Son? So is it tied in with the salvation message that God really loves you out there, Joe Sinner, but you have to understand what that love entails?
I, of course it brings God glory when someone turns from their sin and follows him. And the reason that it brings him glory is because God's the one who initiates that. He's the one who causes that to happen. I mean, Psalm 14, Romans chapter 3 says there's no one who does good, no one who seeks God. They've altogether become worthless. And if that's true, which it is, there is no one who does that of their own accord. That's why it brings God glory, because he's actually the one who does that. Nobody willingly does it to begin with. I'm not saying that God loves the sin and hates the sinner. I think our fundamental nature is a sinful nature. If that's an attribute of our person, which we're born with, according to Romans chapter 5, you cannot separate. You can't separate that from us. That's part of who we are. There's no. There's no such division. I mean, obviously, yes, God hates sin, but if that's part of our, if that's a fundamental part of our nature, there's no division between sin and sinner. I mean, if you're a sinner, you are sin incarnate. So it may hit a raw nerve, but I think the fact of the matter is that God, in his holiness, who cannot stand a spot, a speck on of dirt on a white sheet of righteousness. No, he has no love for the sinner at the end of the day. When all is said and done and Christ comes in his judgment, like I said, God will not send those that he loves to hell. Okay? Now, in the sense that God grieves for his lost creation after he judges it, I think that's legitimate, and I think that can be reconciled. It doesn't mean that he has a heartfelt, warm and cozy feeling for somebody he just sent to hell that he can't get over. It means that this is something that I created. It rebelled against me, and look what I had to do. This is my creation, my own creation, that I'm having to destroy. So yeah, I think it's pretty black and white. In the answer. Now, you said it hit a raw nerve, but it sounded like when you were asking the question that you were actually in agreement with what I was saying. So, yeah, or maybe I misunderstood. Okay. Oh, we do, big time. There is, I mean, not only do people find it boring for you to tell them that God loves you and has a righteous plan, or has a wonderful plan for your life. I mean, that's just boring to people these days. They've heard that a million times. Not only is it boring, it's not true. God does not have a wonderful plan for everybody's life. If you think that hell's a wonderful plan, you're greatly deluded. That's not a wonderful plan. And if God is sovereign, and sovereign means that he plans all things from time eternity, and he knows everything that's going to happen. If he's sovereign, he doesn't have a wonderful plan for everyone's life. And if you doubt that, go back and read Romans chapter 9. Go back and read Revelation. Read the Bible. We do need to revisit those cliches. And that's why I say I'm a huge fan of the Way of the Master, because they state it like it is. We are rebels, whether we know it or not, and we need to be confronted with our rebelliousness. We need to be told about it. Now, you go and preach that. That's not boring. That gets people's attention. It gets their back up pretty quickly. You'll get taken right off a university campus by the police if you stand there and say it too long sometimes. So, yeah, we need to confront them with that.
They need to know their state before the Almighty. Now, the way that you say that, you know, I'm speaking to a church crowd here, so I can say, and I would feel comfortable arguing about it in this crowd, that that God has those feelings toward the sinner. But would I approach a person on the street and say that? No, I wouldn't word it quite like that, I don't think. I would cause them to question their state before God, lead them by the law or by what they know is right and wrong, to admit that, yes, they have wronged God. Okay, you admit that, there's a problem. Don't you see it? Yeah, there is a problem. You know, and then take them from there. Yeah, but there's a solution to that problem. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, actually I have a question for your wife, but you kind of touched on it, but besides your ministry for your husband and your kids, what do you feel your ministry would be in this church?
No, honestly, that's the question I'm not sure about. Right now I have little kids. One is 5 months old, the other one is 2 years old. So I feel quite a bit tied to them, doing things for them. Yes, like you said, my ministry would be, first of all, to support my husband, to make things happen for him. A lot of times I have to either stop him or encourage him to do something. So I see myself as that, and of course a mother. When I'm free up, if there's nursery, I'm looking forward to joining a Bible study. I'm looking forward to helping in the nursery. I don't see myself leading a Bible study, but, you know, God knows what's going to happen. I would like to, Noel and I formerly participated in a clothing closet, which was basically a reach out for the poor people. So we fed them, we gave clothes to them, together with the church. So I would like to participate in something like that, if there is such a thing. And honestly, I don't know what else is going on in the church. I think that's all I can say for now.
I'm just thinking about, as far as your relationship with the leadership at the church, primarily, and I guess at first, with my dad, like, how do you plan on cultivating that? And then also with the elders and other, like, ministry leaders. So a really practical question. Both, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I think how I plan on cultivating that, I mean, honestly, for the first quite a while, it will be intensive learning. I think after a while, of course, some of it will start to fall into place. It'll always be intensive learning. I look forward to working with all of the elders. It's a little odd because they keep telling me, well, all of the elders are equals, and I know that. I know that's biblical. Truth of the matter is, some of them have so much more knowledge and wisdom than I do that I look at the elders' meetings that are coming up, and I'm thinking, I'm probably going to say things that they're like, no. We know better. But I think just embracing at first the opportunity to learn from them, and just where I can try and contribute what I can. You know? Yeah, I don't know how else to answer it, really.
Just for the sake of time, is there one more question? Over here.
You mentioned that this position that's being offered here as an associate pastor.
Yeah.
You mentioned that your gifts were in the teaching and the preaching.
That's right.
Where would you see yourself being 10 years from?
one thing that I've learned already from desiring to be in ministry is that there are no such thing as long-term plans. God can, he can change things in a moment, in a moment's notice. Long-term, honestly, I hope to be here. I think this church has great potential to not just grow, but to plant other churches as well. And who knows? Who knows where that will take me, where it will take Jacques, where it will take maybe some of the elders, and Lord willing, a number of the young men and women who are here. So it may be here, continuing in the same capacity. It may be in a church plant somewhere that's just down the road or something. That's a cop-out answer, sorry. but I hope it's here.
Okay, thank you, Noel. Is there, unless there's any urgent question that we've missed? Leo. Okay. I got to put this one in context.
Pushing me out.
Yeah, no, we don't. No, I'll just tell you this. Leo asks a lot of questions when you're teaching. And they come.
It's good. Good.
And I love Leo asking the questions. It's just sometimes they come out of left field sometimes.
Sometimes the teaching comes out.
Well, there you go. Actually, you can answer it if you wish, but Leo's question, do you mind people asking you questions while you're teaching?
No, I love it. I absolutely love it.